Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for November 15, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Three segments scheduled for tonight. First, a brief interview in a couple of minutes with Julia Isaacs, who is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of three recently published reports on inequality and economic mobility in the U.S. About quarter past, or a little before that, we'll hear from Kevin Gallagher on the book he wrote along with a co-author on economic development in Mexico, specifically the use of foreign investment, which has not been very successful in launching any kind of serious economic development in Mexico. And we'll hear from Kevin Gallagher on why that is. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview with Laura Augustin, who is an independent researcher and the author of the book Sex at the Margins, Migration, Labor Markets, and the Rescue Industry, about migrant sex workers. And the problems with all of those concepts. And since this is a fully loaded show and the three interviews are all previously recorded, I'll keep this opening comments short. What else is there to talk about in the economic headlines but the continuing credit crisis? Several more banks have announced major write-offs, which is the accountant's way of saying they've recognized big losses. Two of them are headquartered in London, HSBC and Barclays, emphasizing once again that the problems in the U.S. mortgage market have had worldwide repercussions. Estimates of total losses from this disaster are now congregating in the $250 to $300 billion range, which is big, but probably not system-threatening. But so far, the write-offs announced by the big banks are only a small fraction of that estimated total, suggesting there's a lot more skeleton-bearing closets yet to be opened. The total loss estimates have been creeping upwards, and I suspect we're going to see those numbers work their way considerably higher in the coming weeks and months until they reach outlandish levels, which is when we'll probably know that the worst of all this is behind us, but we are not there yet. Several reports released over the last few days have shown a weak and possibly weakening U.S. economy. Retail sales in the month of October were quite disappointing, suggesting that without the prop of a housing boom, the earnings of American consumers are just not enough to keep the flywheel of mega consumption turning. And this morning it was announced that first-time claims for unemployment insurance were up a surprisingly large 20,000, continuing an uptrend in place for the last several weeks. I don't think our economy is in recession, though it may be on the cusp of one, but it might be more accurate to think of it as having serious structural problems, weak job growth, excessive debt, and a lopsided distribution of income that are coming into full view now that the housing bubble has burst. Speaking of lopsided distribution of income, our first segment is an interview recorded yesterday with Julia Isaacs, a fellow at the Brookings Institution, and the reports are republished by the Economic Mobility Project. She's the author of three reports on inequality and mobility in the U.S. And not to spoil a surprise, but American society is nowhere as mobile as myth would have it, but it is very unequal. For the reports and related material, check out economicmobility.org. Economic Mobility, all one word. .org. Okay, Julia Isaacs.
First of all, this is a panel study, which is something different from the more familiar annual, say, Census Bureau income and poverty reports. Could you just lay out what the difference is and how that's important?
Yes, it's exciting to be working with this panel study because we have such rich data. We're tracking families, the same families across generations, starting in 1968 when the children are 0 to 18 and following these children throughout their lives until we have data through 2002. With the Census Bureau data, which we also published in our report, you can compare how people on average were doing, let's say, in 2004 to how they were doing on average 30 years earlier. What we can do is directly compare people today with their own parents and see whether Americans are doing have higher income than their own parents.
All right, well, let's start with a top-level view. The averages broad family incomes are up over the last 30 years. How much?
Yes, they are up, and we found that two out of three Americans have higher income than their parents, which is what we would generally expect in a growing economy. We would want each generation to do better than the one before it.
So then let's contrast men and women. How are men and women doing over the last 30 years or so?
So what was perhaps not surprising to economists, but I'm not sure that those of us in the more general public were aware, was how flat men's earnings are. When we looked at men in their 30s, this is now using the cross-sectional data, the general Census Bureau data, not the panel study, we saw that men in their 30s, their income, like in 1974 to 2004, did not increase. In fact, there was a 12% decline, whereas women had this large increase in income over this time. Back in 1974, women's individual earnings, not counting the earnings of their spouse, were quite low. There were a number of women who had no earnings. And now many more women are in the workforce. They have many more have college educations, have higher wages. And so women's earnings are much higher in 2004 than they were in 1974. They're still lower than men's earnings, but the point is that the growth in family income is driven by the entry of women into the labor force.
Now let's also look at mobility. How much is one's economic fate determined by the family one is born into?
Well, that's one of our findings, is that family background has a fairly strong influence on children's economic success. So if your parents are poor, or if your parents are African American at any income level, you don't rise as high on the income ladder. So if we look at children whose parents are in the bottom fifth, those children, 42% of them remain in the bottom fifth themselves. And we find the same thing at the top, that people who are at the top, that their parents are at the top, 39% stay at the top. Economists call this stickiness at the ends of the income distribution. And 6% of poor children make this rags-to-riches climb from the bottom to the fifth, to the top fifth, in one income, in one generation.
And how common is the reverse, the riches-to-rags story?
The reverse, going from riches to rags, as you said, would be 9%.
So in other words, the view of the United States as a remarkably mobile society is somewhat exaggerated, isn't it?
I think it is somewhat exaggerated. I'll be doing another report in late February that talks more about cross-national comparisons, but already I can tell you that we have less mobility than in other countries, whereas we think we have more mobility than other countries.
You divided the population into four broad groups that characterize their economic fate. What are those, and what shares of the population fall into those?
Yes, I had said already that 2 out of 3 have higher income than their parents, but only 1 out of 3 have higher income than their parents and go up one quintile or more. Another 1 out of 3 fall into these middle categories. One of them we call riding the tide. By that we mean that their incomes are going up with the overall economic, whole income ladder is going up, but they aren't going up beyond their parents in economic ranking. And we find a few Americans that are falling despite the tide, which means they have higher income than their, let's say you might make $10,000 more than your parents, but the rest of the society has gone up even further, so you're actually lower in economic standing. Finally, my last category is downwardly mobile, and that 1 out of 3 fail to rise in either income or rank.
And what is the explanation of the different fates of men and women? Why are men's incomes so flat while women's incomes have been rising over the decades?
Well, we split this out into sort of three components. One was the percentage of people employed, and for men, that's been falling slightly, just about 1% over this period, whereas for women, there's been a huge increase in labor force participation. We also looked at the hours worked for those who are working. Again, for men, we saw, you know, a small decline in the hours worked. But for women who are working, many more of them are now working full-time versus part-time. Finally, looking at sort of hourly wages, again, for men, there was a decline, and for women, there was a dramatic increase. So in all three components of annual income, we're seeing women having dramatic increase and men really stagnating or slight decline.
And then finally, race. Because of limitations of the data, you can only look at black versus white, but what do we know about how blacks versus whites are doing in absolute income terms?
In absolute income terms, we see that about 2 out of 3 black families have higher income, black individuals have higher income than their parents. However, this is driven by the fact that it's easier to have higher income than your parents if you start lower down. And so when we control for income, let's say we look at those who are in the middle income bracket, we find that 2 out of 3 white children have higher income than their parents, but only 1 out of 3 black children have higher income than their parents. And I think this is one of the most provocative findings in the report, because it's saying that a majority of African-American children from sort of the middle income group, not from a particularly poor group, end up with lower family income than their parents.
And you didn't find your findings on the black-white income gap were not very encouraging either, were they?
Right. Yeah, we also looked over time and saw that the family income of blacks, we're looking at those who are in their 30s, the family income of blacks was only 58% that of whites who are the same age. And I'm talking about median incomes of about $35,000 compared to $60,000. And there was not progress over time in this. And we looked at it more closely, and what's happening is that for both racial groups, as I've already said, men's incomes are quite flat, but women's incomes are growing, and they're growing even. White women's incomes had been lower to begin with, so it had higher growth, and so white families are getting more of a boost up from the entry of women into the labor force than black families, where there already were a fair number of women in the labor force.
And how are black men doing?
Yeah, so we looked at the individual earnings of white and black men and saw a slight decline for white men, and for black men between 1974 and 2004, we saw a 12% decline.
And women?
That's where we saw this dramatic increase for white women from about $4,000 back in 1974 to $22,000 now, a very large increase. And for black women, median incomes, personal incomes increased from $12,000 to $21,000. So a very, you know, substantial increase, but just not the same magnitude.
Okay. Any broad conclusions you'd like to draw from this?
Well, I just would conclude that we've been seeing this rise in incomes over the generations, but which is good news, but the growth in family incomes has been due to two earners, which puts a strain on the work family. And while incomes are up overall, not all children are benefiting equally from the American dream. And I think our study looked in particular at the fact that children of low-income parents and black children at all income levels do not rise as high on the economic ladder.
And that was the voice of Julia Isaacs, a fellow with the Brookings Institution and author of three studies published by the Economic Mobility Project on inequality and mobility in the United States. And you can find those reports and other stuff at economicmobility.org, economicmobility.org. And we're really rushed tonight to make way for the delightful candidate statements. So let's move right on to hear an interview with Kevin Gallagher, who is a professor of international relations at Boston University, a researcher at Tufts, and co-author of the book The Enclave Economy, Foreign Investment and Sustainable Development in Mexico's Silicon Valley, recently published by the MIT Press. Kevin Gallagher. Before we talk about recent Mexican policy, I'm very curious what import substitution was like in Mexico. What was the Mexican policy regime, you know, in the 50s and 60s before debt and neoliberalism took over?
Yeah, before all that, well, Mexico's certainly done a big pendulum swing. It's probably gone from one of the most closed to one of the most open economies. They had a program, like you said, import substitution industrialization. Keep imports out so you can develop your own industries and make things that that could possibly someday compete in the world economy. Worked for some countries, Taiwan, Korea, somewhat in Brazil. Mexico wasn't so successful about it.
Why didn't it work in Mexico?
Well, a whole bunch of reasons why it didn't work in Mexico. It did diversify the economy. If you look at Mexico before import substitution industrialization, it was oil and agriculture, and they had a formidable manufacturing sector. Steel, cement, cars, trucks, and so forth. But when you look back in 2007, you can't really name a big company like Embraer in Brazil, which is a global leader in aircraft. You can't name a Kia, a Hyundai, or an Acer Computers like you can in Korea or Taiwan. And now if we just look across the ocean in China, they've been experimenting with similar policies, and we already have household names. Lenovo has bought IBM's ThinkPad, and Haier makes a big number of our air conditioners and so forth.
Well, if we go back to that period of the 60s, 70s, the Asian countries had very heavy state hand in their economy, but they also were very export-oriented. Mexico was not export-oriented, right? Did that make a difference?
Yeah, you nailed it right there. That is perhaps the biggest difference. The Asian countries said, we're going to support our industries, but we're going to also require that a big percentage of those industries have to export their products. That meant people like you or me had to make a decision about a product that they were making without any constraints. Hey, the car had to drive down the road. If it drove down the road, if it wasn't too expensive, we'd buy it. Mexico, on the other hand, decided to use their own market as a laboratory and not really compete with other companies from other countries. So they forced their own folks to buy the products that they were trying to build up, but they weren't really at the technological frontier because they didn't have to compete. Cars didn't work so well, but You had no other choice, so you went with it. When they opened their economy, a lot of these things fell by the wayside because they couldn't be at the technological frontier.
There is a tendency on some circles to romanticize the import substitution past, but there was a very cozy and corrupt relation between the industrialists and the state, wasn't there?
Absolutely. That's another reason why it failed. The Ann Krugers of the world call that rent-seeking. That's a nerd professor way to say corruption, and exactly what you just said. There was strange bedfellows came around these policies. Yes, they created some industries, but in the end, there was a corrupt nest that needed some serious reform. The Asians were able to circumvent some of this stuff by being a little bit better at state-led industrialization. One thing you can say about Mexico that was positive, that's missing today, is that they had a plan. They had a comprehensive plan to develop their economy. Now they've decided to say what we call in our book the Maquila mindset. Let's just let the market do it, and that obviously isn't working either.
Yeah, when did that shift happen? How did that Maquila mindset take hold?
We get the name from the Maquiladora Industrialization Program, which started in the 1960s, which were small export processing zones. But the mindset really started to take hold in Mexico and across Latin America with the debt crisis in the early 1980s. The international institutions, World Bank and IMF, started to permeate the region and put conditions on the countries to use many of the different neoliberal policies as condition to get loans and get their economies bailed out. Also from the inside, since many of the old programs weren't working, there was a tendency to have sort of a pendulum swing and try the complete opposite.
Mexico was sort of the pioneer country in a lot of ways because it was the first to announce it had a really serious debt problem in August 82, and then it became kind of the laboratory of neoliberal restructuring. And it's lucky or unlucky enough to have a long border with the United States. So how did Mexico, is it because of that closeness to the United States that Mexico really acquired this this special role?
Well, I think you said it. They happened. Their crisis was the shot that was heard around the world. So they were forced, because of the crisis, to try something new. Part of it was put on them by as conditionality by the international institutions and by the United States, because we also helped out. But part of it was an endogenous or homegrown interest in experimenting with other ideas because the previous ones weren't working, and there was this ingrained corruption and so forth.
So what was the new development strategy? As import substitution was junked, what took its place?
There has been a liberalization-based development policy in Mexico since the late 1980s. By liberalization, I mean, or Washington Consensus, as we know it here in the United States. Get the state out of as many economic affairs as you can, except for some small things on governance and property rights. That the state creates all these distortions. That trying to focus on development as a state goal isn't an idea. You need to create the right kind of conditions for markets to do their magic. And once you can create those conditions, the magic will occur. Governments will get out of the way and economies will grow. That pendulum swing has proven that it didn't happen either.
How does NAFTA fit into this? A lot of people think of it as central, but it was about 10 or 12 years into this process that the treaty took effect. So how important was NAFTA in this evolution in Mexican policy?
NAFTA is important because it's a capstone and a lock-in to the policies. Yes, you're right. Mexico did a lot of these policies unilaterally, or at least with international institutions up until the 1990s. But it was actually Mexico, Carlos Salinas, that called up George Bush and said, I want a North American free trade agreement. It locked in a lot of these policies. Now it would be even very difficult to reverse them. If you go back to the controversial elections of 2006, both candidates, the big issue was about the economy. They had two different visions of the economy, but neither of them wanted to tinker substantially with NAFTA because it's really off the table. It would be very difficult to do so.
So the centerpiece of this new development strategy was to attract foreign investment, foreign direct investment, that is, investment in plants or in the purchase of existing properties rather than just pure financial investment. What is the charm of foreign direct investment for a government, and why is it such a favored development strategy in scores of countries around the world?
Sure. It's really seen as part of the flagship that you want to have in a liberalization or market-led investment development strategy, especially in a country like Mexico that had a number of financial crises in 82, as you talked about, and again in 1994. That's when you've got foreign currency trading and all sorts of things that can move in and out of a country really quickly that you're much more of an expert on than I am, Doug. Foreign direct investment has a better promise to some because you're building an actual physical plant that you can't pick up and move away in 3 hours like you can get a currency out of a country in 3 hours. It's also going to hire real people who are going to go do real work inside these plants. And Mexico has a serious unemployment issue. As we know, over 400,000 people are trying to get into the United States every year. Mexico would like to see those people absorbed into their own economy.
And how successful has this strategy been?
The strategy has been very limited at best, and we call our book the Enclave Economy because on one hand, Mexico took a step forward. After all this liberalization, they have been able to capture an incredible amount of foreign investment. Most foreign investment just goes to big developed countries. 75% of all foreign investment goes to developed countries. Of the small amount that goes to developing countries, though, the bulk of it goes to Brazil, China, and Mexico. So Mexico is a big recipient, and a lot of it has to do with the liberalization strategy. However, they're getting all this foreign investment. It's not translating into sustainable jobs and rippling into the economy to create growth. Mexican economy's only been growing a little over 1% a year in per capita terms since this whole strategy started.
If foreign investment is to work, to use the jargon of the trade, there's supposed to be forward and backward linkages. Talk about what those are and whether it worked in Mexico.
We call our book The Enclave Economy because there's very limited forward and backward linkages. There was one of the things that attracted the firms to begin with was that there was a somewhat vibrant electronics and high-tech industry in Mexico. That's what attracted a lot of the firms, is to have these other firms as possible suppliers. But foreign firms came, decided to import all their inputs. Imported inputs are 90%, 98% of all the inputs in each of these firms, and wiped out all the local firms that were there. Very much like a Walmart effect in the United States. When a Walmart moves to a small town, all of a sudden many of the competing industries fall by the wayside. Same thing happened when foreign firms entered Mexico.
I'm speaking with Kevin Gallagher, who is the author, along with Lyuba Zarsky, of The Enclave Economy, recently published by MIT Press. And, of course, there's forward linkages that the products of these operations are supposed to stimulate local economic development. That didn't happen in Mexico with the electronics industry, right?
That didn't happen either. Many of the things that are being produced at these firms are PCs, personal computers, laptops, cell phones, things like that, high-tech things that that can help people be more efficient, or workaholics, like in your case and mine. But that didn't happen because 98% of everything that's produced in these plants goes back to the United States. Only 2% of the demand, 2% of what the companies are producing actually finds its way into the Mexican markets.
Mexico also was a victim of some bad timing because the dot-com bubble burst, and then China really entered the scene in a big way. So what were the effects of those two events on Mexico's electronics ambitions?
Yeah, we started doing this work in 2002. Everyone who we talked to when we were going to all the plants and meeting with labor leaders and meeting with environmentalists were just talking about the sector being just gangbusters. The dot-com boom was still happening, and there were lots of jobs. The focus was, how do we make the jobs more sustainable? How do we make this less environmentally harmful? By 2004, 2005, all everyone is talking about is China. In the year 2000, Mexico and China both had about 6% apiece of world electronics markets. Now China has 22.8% of the world market, and Mexico only has 3.5%.
Now, that's not as fast as currency trading, but that's pretty fast.
That's pretty fast.
So the idea that foreign direct investment would be somehow more stable proved elusive.
It did prove elusive. It's a lot more volatile in today's global economy than it was in the early 1990s. What Mexico still does have it going for itself right now, though, is that it's close proximity to the U.S. market. I'm a professor. Universities need millions of computers every August. Takes 18 days to get it from Beijing. It can take 18 hours to get it from Mexico. You're going to order some of your stuff from Mexican plants. They're not going to go away, but they're not connected to the economy, and they're nowhere near as competitive as their Chinese counterparts in the 21st century.
Although the iMac over my shoulder says, designed by Apple in California, made in China, that seems to be where most of the action really is. And Mexico is kind of a minor player now in electronics, isn't it?
Mexico is a minor player in electronics, and it is true that the majority of the research and development and the design and the real high value-added parts of the production chain are occurring in the United States, Japan, and parts of Europe. But some of the state-owned enterprises in China are doing the same. Of course, we know the famous story that Lenovo bought the IBM ThinkPad. If you look at the electronics industry in China, the majority of the plants are either joint ventures between state-owned or national companies and foreign companies, or they're actually national or state-owned companies themselves.
Just parenthetically, there's a line among critics of NAFTA and foreign investment that one of the attractions of a place like Mexico is that it's an environmental dumping ground. Did you find that in your work?
No, we didn't. And I wrote another book about this that looked at Mexico, the Mexican economy in general, and we found that firms don't move to Mexico because of their weaker environmental standards. Unfortunately, that finding, which is pretty universal except with some exceptions, has been completely misunderstood in the policy context. Because firms don't move to developing countries because they can dump, doesn't mean that when they move there, they don't dump. The policy community has said, oh good, there's no pollution haven, as this is called. Firms aren't moving there. That's just a theory about why firms move. It says nothing about their behavior when they get there. We went to these plants and found out that on many pollutants, especially those related to worker health and safety, plants in Mexico are much dirtier than their California-based counterparts.
Well, I guess if they can dump, they will, right?
Yeah, if they can, they will, although we did find that when pollution is more of a function of the basics of your plant, like these are all brand new companies, brand new plants that were built in the 1990s, they actually use less water and use less energy than their California counterparts. You know, if you're going to build something that new in the 1990s, it's probably going to be cleaner than it was if you built one in the 1980s when many of the ones in California were built. But when pollution's more of a function of these things that you've got to regulate, like end-of-pipe technologies, the toxics that workers are using in the workplace and so forth, yeah, that's where the government's got to step in and do the inspections. In the U.S., we do that, and especially in California. In Mexico, they don't. We met with local officials. There's only 4 inspectors for the entire state of Jalisco, and they all spend their time in the tanneries industry. They haven't been to the Mexican electronics plants yet.
The Asians, Korea a decade or two ago, China more recently, have been quite successful at technology transfer and building up local supply chains and such. Why did they succeed and Mexico fails? Just they have more bargaining power, more competent state? What's behind this disparity?
Both of those and some more. One message that I want to make sure that I get through is that our book does not say that foreign investment is bad for development. As a matter of fact, you need foreign investment to be able to develop your economy. It's how you develop quality foreign investment to generate spillovers is the challenge. And many of the Asian countries have struck the right balance. I would say that they have struck a better balance on the economic aspects of globalization. They're successful economic globalizers. They've been able to use leverage to be able to get foreign firms to come to their country, but also to build up the local supplier base, to get research and development going on there and so forth. They're still lagging behind on environment and labor issues, though.
So what lessons can we draw from this Mexican experience for broader policy strategies?
Thanks. I think there's 3. One, foreign direct investment or foreign investment in general isn't a means. I mean, isn't an ends. It's a means. It should be seen as a means toward development. And Mexico and many other countries are making the vital mistake right now is thinking, all I need to do is get the foreign company to come here. If I get the foreign company to come here, all this other stuff is automatically going to happen. That's not the case. Foreign direct investment should be seen as a means toward development, not an ends in and of itself. Secondly, you have to have complementary policies at home for your local firm for them to be able to reap the benefits of foreign investment. Mexico didn't do that either. And third, when you're signing trade agreements or if you're signing trade agreements, you got to make sure they have the policy space for you to be able to put in place those domestic policies.
Could a future Mexican government do those sorts of things, or are their hands so tied by NAFTA that they couldn't really?
Mexico is significantly tied by NAFTA, but there's still room to move. Mexico first has to overcome this maquila mindset. Mexican governments need to move beyond this idea that the market's going to allocate all these things perfectly. The evidence is there in black and white. Some things you still can do under NAFTA, which would be very important, would be to provide access to credit for small and medium-sized enterprises. A lot of these firms, if they were going to be able to sell to some of the foreign firms when they came here, would have needed to have scaled up their production and increased their technological capabilities a little bit. If they didn't have access to foreign capital at a high interest rate, they couldn't touch it. That's what happened. Giving access to capital is something you can still do under NAFTA, and it's one example of something that, with a maquila mindset, you're just not going to do.
And that was the voice of Kevin Gallagher, who is a professor of international relations at Boston University, researcher at Tufts, and co-author, along with Luba Zarsky, of The Enclave Economy, Foreign Investment and Sustainable Development in Mexico's Silicon Valley, recently published by MIT Press. And we are pressed for time, so I'm going to do the station ID and everything myself. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 on your FM dial, and WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News, and moving right along. A few weeks ago, the National Organization for Women's New York chapter organized a protest against New York Magazine, urging the magazine to drop its sex ads in the back. And before they could even hold the demonstration, New York Magazine agreed to their demands and withdrew the sex ads. And Now's rationale was that these sorts of ads promoted trafficking in women, and they view this as part of their anti-trafficking campaign. And that gave me a nice news hook for an interview I was planning to do anyway, but... This actually gives us a local, a real-world hook here. This interview was with Laura Augustin, who is the author of the book Sex at the Margins, Migration, Labor Markets, and the Rescue Industry, recently published by Zed. And all these concepts of trafficking and similar things are extremely complicated. Migration, also very complicated. And Laura Augustin does a very fine job of sorting this all out in this book, Sex at the Margins. So let's listen to this interview with her, recorded a couple of weeks ago, actually. Laura Augustin.
The National Organization of Women was up in arms about trafficking, which is a word that we frequently hear in association with prostitution and other forms of sex work. What do you make of this word, trafficking?
Well, 10 years ago, I really didn't hear it very much. It's the concept of white slavery comes from a very long time ago. There isn't anything brand new about this. But until recently, when everyone got so excited about illegal migration again, there wasn't such a worry about trafficking. And the issue is really about people crossing borders to work without having all the proper permits and things. And why are people selling sex more exciting than everyone else doing illegal work? Because sex is always more exciting to everyone.
But there's also a sense in which women are being pressed into service. It is a form of slavery, and it's not like other forms of labor or migrant labor, which is assumed to be in some sense voluntary.
I wouldn't agree with that. The problem is that organizations that want to take a very particular feminist view on prostitution, who want to see that always when people are selling sex, it's slavery, those people are trying to impose that notion on all the rest of us. Now, there are sex worker rights movements that are pretty accepted, even by some of these feminists that I think of as kind of fundamentalist feminists. But they tend to apply any kind of idea about working as a choice or a preference to real citizens, white people, privileged people of richer countries, and not to people who come from the third world or the global south. That's, for me, what the issue is.
There's also an issue around migrants, which is an interesting word, too, because it's not applied to, say, a bond trader from India who is working in London.
No.
It's applied only to certain groups of people.
So, yes.
Well, you have a long and sophisticated analysis of travel and migration,
yeah.
So give us a little bit of that.
Okay, well, you know, also, it used to be for like a country of, like the United States is referred to as a country of immigration. In fact, the immigration to the United States and Australia took place in exactly the way that what's being called migration and illegal migration is now. There really isn't any difference. In the model of an immigration model says that people in another country decide completely voluntarily that they will go somewhere else and settle forever and not return. And the migration word was more familiar when talking about birds or fish, right? You have migrating birds. But then it was kind of realized in the last 20 years that lots of human beings do the same thing. They come back and forth. They don't really expect to get a definite work permit. They know it's going to be too hard. And so they kind of migrate back and forth, and they maintain more than one home. And there is definitely a class usage for migration these days. It doesn't have to be like that, but that's how it is. So that for those who are getting visas through embassies in a completely formal, official way, and of course those do tend to be people who have more money and have white skin, then that will be seen as some kind of immigration or clear voluntary work permit situation. And everyone else is called a migrant, so that the word begins to mean something poor and economically miserable, forced, the people moved by disasters, and people who have been enslaved.
And from your research, that is not really a very faithful representation of people that are being talked about, right?
No. The problem with the conversation is that very often it's easier to talk about the extremes. So it's much easier to put at one end of a spectrum the Wall Street bond trader and who, you know, has every benefit and every privilege, and at the other end, the miserable brown woman who was definitely enslaved. And so we know that both of those exist. The question is when you try to make everyone belong to one of these two categories. Human life is much more complicated than that. And so lots and lots and lots of people travel to work somewhere else, whether they're going to be a maid or a fruit picker or a sex worker or whatever. They do it knowing something about what they'll be doing. They don't know everything. They have to take risks. They have to take chances. They have to buy the services of someone at some point to help them. They have to trust. They can make mistakes. And the mistakes can lead to very big troubles. But you don't hear about all the huge numbers of people that don't get into any trouble.
I was going to ask you about this portrayal of the women who do sex work as victims, and then I stopped myself, and I think it's important to make the point that they're not all women who do sex work, right?
Yeah, that's right. What's happened is that for a particular kind of feminist that hates prostitution, the conversation is only about women who sell sex to men. It's not that they don't know that men and transsexuals and intergender people and cross-dressers sell sex. They do know that. We all know that. And probably it's just as many of all those people as women who do it. For those of us who do research in the field, it feels as though there's as many men and boys and transgenders as women, but there aren't any real data here, so we can't prove that. However, the concern, the social concern, is about women, and that's your classic gender analysis. That's who they're worried about, women.
And in that kind of thinking is often an identification of women with colonized countries, and since many of the migrant women who do sex work are from those colonized countries, the patrons are seen as imperial violators, right?
Yes, yes. I was looking at a picture the other day that someone sent me in a great moral outrage that showed a middle-aged white man he wasn't fat, but he looks like a middle-aged person. So he's white, and he's walking along with a young, shorter, brown woman. And this image all by itself is meant to provoke our violent opposition. This is also pretty crude, but we live in a big patriarchal world in which men have more money and more options in general everywhere. They are the ones that can buy more sexual services more easily. They do travel a lot. Whether you want to call it imperialism, well, I guess it is, but there's a lot of other kinds of imperialism going on as well. So this isn't really different. This is more about sexism in general.
You write some about how the motives of the men who patronize female sex workers are not all violent and exploitative. There's a search for companionship or tenderness. I mean, why do men buy sex, as you put it in one of your chapter subheads?
Yeah, why do they? If we ask it the question that way, then we frame the debate to be, well, we frame the idea to be that there's something perverse about this, that why do you do this? Would you ask someone in a market research, you wouldn't go to someone and say, why do you eat chocolate? As though there was something wrong with eating chocolate. So again, we've got the whole thing framed now as why do you do this? It's obviously wrong. And that seems to me not very interesting. When men have been asked this, all kinds of men have been asked this,
which ones answer? Well, you can, the ones who feel like answering, and they say all kinds of things that are quite banal, like, I like to go out to different kinds of restaurants, so why not have different kinds of sex? Or my wife won't do, or I need something to do at night, or I'm disabled, no one wants to have sex with me, or I don't have anything else to do. It's pretty banal. So I think that probably the more interesting questions have to do with what's going on in general in the different kinds of venues and situations where people buy and sell sex to each other.
The fundamentalist feminist view of sex work, as you, to use your phrase, is that the women who do it are suffering to some degree or other. And you quote someone in the book as saying, if you're not suffering, then you're not a prostitute. What about that suffering? I mean, how much, how accurate is that?
How much suffering?
How much suffering is there?
Well, I think the real problem here is that the people taking that position would find it inconceivably horrible to have to sell sex themselves. It sounds like the worst possible thing, and there are plenty of people who claim to feel that way, who say that they would rather die. The people who say that are generally in more comfortable situations where they aren't presented with few options about how to work and make any kind of decent money or how to travel. So it's framed like that. The old debate about prostitution, and that's still a good word, we can still use that word, plenty of prostitutes like being called prostitutes, is about whether one kind of person's definition of suffering and unhappiness has to be imposed on everyone else. So this is really a conversation about sex. This is really about whether you think that sexual actions belong absolutely in a perfect world only in relationships of people who are in love forever and have a home and want to do it in private, and are completely consenting, this idea called consenting adults, where there's no money, and it's all loving, and it's all mutual. This is a very idealistic view of what sex will be, and it leaves out all kinds of people all over the world who like to have public sex, anonymous sex, commercial sex, who like to go to fetish clubs, who like to listen to phone online. It leaves all that out. But so that's where the idea of suffering comes from.
I'm speaking with Laura Maria Agustin, who is the author of Sex at the Margins, recently published by Zed Books.
Yeah, it's as if the idea of sex behind that is something that should occur to a soundtrack of lush violins and, with sweet scents, but nothing violent or nothing...
Right. We already know that's not true. My email is filled every day with people who are claiming the rights to this or sadomasochism or whatever it is. We know that culturally sex is all kinds of things to all kinds of people, and that you can be white and privileged and like to be a swinger or like to buy sex and also have a loving wife. So these are really very reductionist kind of notions.
You have a very interesting historical view of the emergence of this kind of impulse to rescue in the 18th and 19th century. Could you give us the history of that?
Yes, well, when I first started thinking about this, I didn't even know that there was a great moral debate. I didn't understand what it was about because I was in Latin America and the economies are all pretty crappy and lots of people migrate and try to get whatever job they can get, and it was quite well known that you could make more money. This was people coming to Europe, and so it was quite well known that you could get very big money selling sex in Spain, for instance. But if you didn't want to do that, you could be a maid and make less, but maybe you would like that better. But I didn't know. This was maybe the mid-90s. People weren't talking about trafficking. However,
so it's much less degrading to clean someone's toilet than it is to have sex with them, right?
Yes, well, that's the idea, Doug. That is the idea, that there's something inherently so terrible about having sex for money that anything is preferable. And, of course, this is not what people's testimonies say. There are some people, for instance, let's take out cleaning toilets. What about being a drug mule? That's a really, really hard job. So there are women who have been caught and who are in prison, for instance. I know some of these women in Spain who carried large quantities of cocaine in plastic bags in their stomachs across the border, and they were caught. Now, that's a really hard job. You had to swallow enormous quantities of those bags of drugs, and then you had to get rid of them publicly at the other end, and someone was watching you. This is pretty hard work. It's got a, you get a lot of money for it, but it's very difficult. So some people would, but some of the women who were caught doing that said, well, I would never do prostitution. I would rather do this. So these are very personal kinds of ideas about what's dignified and what's not dignified and how you're willing to use your body.
Well, let's get back to the emergence of rescue and philanthropy.
Yes. Yes, well, so I also, even 15 years ago, 12 years ago, didn't really understand why, given the situation I was in, why I would come to Europe, which is where this trafficking thing started being screaming about much before in the U.S., why it was such a difficulty for all these people, and why people in Europe were all talking about these trafficked slaves and having to rescue people. And so I did a lot of talking to people and field work and reading, but then I decided it must go into the past. So I went back and I satisfied myself that by the explanation that has to do with a phenomenon called the rise of the social, which was after the revolutions and during the Enlightenment in Europe, when the kings were being thrown out and the idea of divine right was being thrown out, and the bourgeoisie was coming into its own for the first time they'd been struggling for a long time to get any kind of social power. And at this period, people who were socially conscious decided that they needed to figure out how society should be and what the right way to live was. And those people became kind of social philosophers and made categories of people who were living the good way and living the bad way. And when they defined certain people as living the bad way, they automatically made themselves be the ones living the good way and the ones who should be able to help those who are wrong. So you get the evolution of social work in which people go out and try to find those who live on the street or who drink too much or who don't cook their own food at home or who aren't married. These were the kind of categories that were considered very upsetting and terrible in the early 19th century. So you got these social explorers going into London's East End, being amazed at the poor people and their practices and their strange habits and trying to get them to come and live in this bourgeois way. And this was the beginning of an idea that some people were victims and should be brought inside, and prostitutes were clearly identified at that time as needing to be saved from this terrible fate.
That's interesting in the light of the fact that today's the kind of feminist, the now kind of feminist who want to rescue women from prostitution, find themselves in alliance with social conservatives who on which they would agree with almost nothing else.
That's right.
How did that alliance emerge, and what do you make of it? How does it stay together?
Well, you know what? Lots of people are always saying that these are unlikely alliances. I guess to me, because of the way I came into this, it's never seemed unlikely, because it was like that from the beginning. I'm not sure sometimes that the fundamentalist feminists that are really worried about getting the definitions right, I'm not sure that they completely realize, but maybe I'm being naive, that what they propose serves the state who wants to deport people and who wants to make limited immigration policy. The alliance came about simply because they do both of these, the religious and the fundamentalist feminist, they're both fundamentalist tendencies, have the view of sex in common. That's what they have in common. They have that idea about how it should be in a mutually consenting over 18 couple doing everything the nice way with the violins. They have that in common. That the family, something called the family, is the most important thing. Now, some of these fundamentalist feminists are, in fact, gay, but then they believe in civil unions. So still the idea is that there's some kind of committed, socially responsible couple, going on. That's what they really have in common. And I think they just suspend all of their other differences. They suspend it in order to get this fear about trafficked women and slavery, modern slavery, to get that across to the public.
There's an aspect of rescue and condescension even in people who are trying to do solidarity work with sex workers. I mean, what is the proper way to approach this for people who are sympathetic and would like to help folks out without coming off like some sort of rescuing angel?
Well, I guess, you know, the major contribution that I have about this, I get asked this all the time, is when you, to have the desire to help other people and to be in solidarity is clearly a very common human desire. It's something that makes human beings human. The question is, when you decide to do something, on what are you basing your actions? Are you basing it on a theory of what you think sexual suffering is or how you would like the world to be? Or are you talking to people about their real situations and finding out what they want? So the trafficking in persons report that the U.S. puts out issues a report card to the rest of the world on how they're doing. No one's asking anything about what the actual people who are selling sex want. And the rescue missions that are being carried out in different countries are going in and raiding brothels without checking first to see whether people would like to be liberated or not. So you get these huge, horrible contradictions. Now, if you're talking about someone handing out condoms on an outreach van, that might be pretty mild and okay. However, contradictions do come up there too. So what I try to say to people is that before just taking action and taking stands and setting up a new nonprofit organization, talk to a lot of the people involved about what they would actually like. In the case of migrant sex workers, it's going to be some way to be legal in the country that they're in.
This actually sort of takes us back to where we started, because the by getting New York Magazine to drop the ads for sex work, they've actually undermining the livelihood of the people they're trying to rescue.
Yeah, this thing about prohibiting ads, I've seen it in a lot of countries. It's very crude. It's extremely crude. It's some kind of idea that if you stop the marketplace from existing, you'll get everyone to stop buying and selling sex. That's pretty silly. Because it meant, first of all, most publications that want to continue to carry the ads and advertising on the internet isn't affected at all. But the other function, and this is clearly what, you know, they're doing, both New York Magazine, they were very clear in what they said, that this is, it's a moralistic action. It's to stop, it's to take a stand, to stop people from seeing these offensive ads, to show in word and deed that you do not support something. The fact is that, yes, some people who were getting all their clients from those ads, it's a big pain. They have to now figure out another way to find them, of course, but they will.
And that was the voice of Laura Augustine, who is the author of Sex at the Margins, Migration, Labor Markets, and the Rescue Industry, recently published by Zed Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. We're a little rushed tonight because have to make way for some candidate statements. And be sure to vote because the stakes are high and it's very important. So I will be preempted next week, so I will see you in 2 weeks. And let's go out with an abbreviated listen to this new song from Bloc Party. Till 2 weeks from now. Bye.